Yo so Bhagava Alahang Sama Sambuddho Sovakato Yena Bhagavata Dhammo Supatipanno Yassa Bhagavato Savaka Sango Tamayam Bhagavantam Sadamang Sasangang Ime Hisaka Vehiyatavahang Aropite Hiyabipujayama Sadhuno Bhante Bhagava Suchira Parinibhutopi Pachima Janata Nukampamanasa Ime Sakare Dugata Panakalabhute Patiganhatu Amhakang Dikharatang Hitaya Sukhaya Alahang Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sango Sangam Namami Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhassa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhassa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhassa Itipiso Bhagava Arahang Sama Sambuddho Vija Charana Sampano Sugato Lokavidu Anuttaro Purisa Dhamma Sarati Sata Deva Manu Sanang Buddha Bhagava Tamahang Bhagavantang Abhipujayami Tamahang Bhagavantang Sirasanamami Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Sandittiko Akaliko Ehipassiko Opanayiko Pachatang Veditabo Vinyuhi Tamahang Dhammang Abhipujayami Tamahang Dhammang Sirasanamami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sango Ujjupatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sango Yayapatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sango Samichipatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sango Yatitang Chatari Purisayugani Atta purissa pugala esa bhagavato savaka sango ahuneyo pahuneyo dakineyo anjali karaniyo anutarang punya ketang lokasa Tamahang Sangang Api Pujayami Tamahang Sangang Sirasanamami. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, not busy with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be happy. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting man, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, upwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, freed from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, but not holding to false use, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Very good. Okay. We have connection to Singapore. If we have an IO, Okay, the questions. Here we go. Hello, Ajahn Brahm. Hi. My mind keeps wandering onto the into the future and into my work and what I'm doing to tell people about what I've learned during my stay, what I'm going to tell people about what I've learned during my stay here. What would you suggest doing when this happens? Oh my goodness. Laugh, that's a good answer. So, one of the things, when you wander off into the future, what's the point of that? You're wasting time. This is an amazing experience. There's only a few days left. You can't afford to waste any experiences wandering in the future. You know that sometimes this happens. It's only, how many days to go? It's Thursday today. Got Friday, Saturday, Sunday. 3 days to go, yeah? So, leave it on. It's fine down there. So, instead of, sometimes people have already started packing their bags. Well, you started making preparations. We always live so much in the future. So instead of actually living so far in the future, it's nice to be here now. Make the best use of this place. It's an incredible place. So enjoy it to the absolute max. It's not 3 days to go. It is 72 hours. It's not 72 hours. It's 4,320. That's 4,320 minutes. It's not just 4,320 minutes. It is 1,000 seconds. And just 1 second. 1 second is enough to get fully in mind. 1 second of seeing unlimited. How can you waste this? Because what happens, if you plan what you're going to tell people when you get back after 3 days, so after 250,000, that's a quarter of a million seconds, you may have to change it all. Because it all changes once you get enlightened, you know. Once you get enlightened, it looks totally different. So all that stuff you've been planning to tell them, it just doesn't apply anymore. Because now you're fully enlightened. What a waste of time that was. Are you convinced?
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Some other people are. But anyway, I'll try my best. Now, after a while, now, living in the present moment, you know, honestly, it's a wonderful thing to do. You'd have to do a little bit of work for the future, you know, do your cleaning up and stuff, but you don't have to do that much. And it's, what a beautiful opportunity it is here. No one is going to criticize you or tell you off for, you know, not doing stuff in the future. They're not going to criticize you for not remembering the past. This is one of the few places in the world where you really can be present. And you're praised for that. What a wonderful place it is, where you're encouraged to be here. Not to do things, achieve things, plan things, make things happen, but just to walk gently through this facility and enjoy it all. Be here. Dear Ajahn, is it correct to say, no, it's not correct to say anything here. We're supposed to be keeping noble silence. Okay, so that sensual pleasures that do not go against the five precepts are okay, as long as we're not attached to them. This is one thing which somebody asked Ajahn Chah about. He said, can you actually indulge in sensory pleasures when you're not attached to them? He said, if you can find salt which isn't salty, fine. That's the nature of sensory pleasures, to attach to them. It's very difficult not to. In fact, it always really happens. So, of course, don't have sensory pleasures that go against the five precepts. But even more than that, it's nice to keep very peaceful and still and free. Just free like the stupas. I know. I don't know why I mentioned those stupas outside. I don't know if you know the secret of those stupas out in the those little gardens out there. Because we wanted something traditional to remind us that this is a beautiful Buddha, a beautiful Buddhist retreat center. We've got the Buddha statues out here. They came a bit later. But they were offered by one of the monks over in Indonesia. And it was the monk who, in Java, Venerable Panyawada, I think his name was. Sri Panyawada, they called him, because he's a lovely monk. And you know, he knew what we were doing over here. And you know, he just got some of his disciples and followers to raise some funds and to get those two stupas out here. They're beautiful. And that's the same stone as from Borobudur. And they're exactly the same design, only they're 108% bigger. A tiny bit bigger, 108%. And there is a myth to those. And the myth is this. It's an old legend. That if you climb on top of that stupa, just on the platform, and you could put your hand inside one of those little cavities by the, like the diamond rocks on the outside, and if you can reach and touch the Buddha statue inside, then you will find true love. Watch it. People are watching you, you know. They'll tell your partner when you get back home. That's what they used to say. And it's true. If you can reach inside and you come and meditate here, you find the true love of the Dhamma. I think that's what it really means. Do you think that's the right explanation? The true love of the Dhamma. I don't know where that came from anyway. But anyway, I thought I'd let you know that. Craving those sensory pleasures is the actual problem. Ooh, you might say that, but really the sensory pleasures create the problem. They create the craving, and the craving creates more interest in those sensory pleasures and more opportunity. That's why people get reborn into this realm. It gives you the opportunity for the mind to play around in the sensory sphere. It's the playground of the five senses, this world. And so we think maybe this time we didn't really get very far, but next time, I'll make sure that I go to the retreat center, touch the Buddha inside, and next time it'll be okay. Ajahn Chakra, he once used to tell me that his favorite Nasruddin story, the Nasruddin was the Sufi monk from Iran many centuries ago. And Nasruddin, he was sitting on the side of the road, and his face was so red, and his eyes were red and were weeping water, and his nose was dripping with stuff which comes out of your nose. And he had a big pile of chili peppers in front of him, and he'd already eaten many chili peppers, and that's why his face was so red and it was weeping water. Know, from his nose and his eyes and his mouth. And one of his friends said, "What are you doing that for?" As he was putting another chili in his mouth. And Nasruddin replied, "I'm looking for the sweet one." And I love that. He loved that. And it's a very good simile. We always think, oh, the next one will be the sweet one. How many do you have to taste before you realize they're all hot? And cause pain. So anyway, so it is not correct to say sensual pleasures that go against the five precepts are okay, as long as we're not attached to them. You do get attached to them. That's the nature, to get attached to them. So it's best to just keep away from them as much as you possibly can. By the way, I didn't have disturbing dreams last night. Your recommendation works. Yay! Well done. You know what the recommendation had to avoid disturbing dreams? Don't go to sleep. Now that wasn't the recommendation. I hope I can share it here. And that recommendation was, when you go to bed at night time, you just lay down, get yourself comfortable, then you make the programming mindfulness. You just tell yourself, you've got to be nice and comfortable, in your own words, as short as possible, I will have a peaceful sleep. Repeat it three times. In your own words. Quick, direct, in your own words, I will have a peaceful sleep. I will have a peaceful sleep. And then you forget about it. And you finally go to sleep and it is peaceful. If you really want to try this, and it's, I did this again my first retreat, I was a student, I was willing to try anything just to see what would happen. And the teacher there said, when you go to sleep at night, forget about your alarm clock. Say you have to get up at 4 o'clock with gusto. So you find out where Mr. Gusto is. Is Gusto or a male? No, so you have to get up at 4 o'clock. So set your alarm for 4:05, if you wish. And then as you go to sleep tonight, when you're all sort of tucked in and nice and peaceful and comfortable, you tell yourself, I will wake up at 4 a.m. tomorrow morning. I will wake up at 4 a.m. tomorrow morning. I will wake up at 4 a.m. tomorrow morning. And then forget it. So I did that, and I couldn't believe it. I woke up, you wake up, and well, what time is it? I can't hear the alarm bell. I didn't wake up because of the alarm bell. I look at the clock, and it was 1 or 2 minutes either side of 4 a.m. It's amazing just how well that works. A little by little, when you trust in that, it's great that it works. Anyway, dear Ajahn, you translate avijja as delusion. Is there a difference in avijja and moha, which is usually translated as delusion, in greed, hate and delusion? No. They have many words for the same thing. Things like heart, mind, consciousness. People say like loving kindness, softness. Well, there's so many words for so many different things. But the avijja here, it's not ignorance, because ignorance is not enough for you to overcome the thing which creates all the problems in the world. It's like delusion. In other words, what you're seeing is real, but you're giving it a meaning it doesn't deserve. Just like the old mirages. You know, you see something out there reflected in the sky, reflected on the road if it's a mirage, and you give it a meaning it doesn't really merit. And that's what delusion is. It distorts your perception. You don't see what is really there, you see what you want to see. Or you distort, you take away what you should be seeing, but no, it's just, it was too hard for me. And that's actually how you can become much more free and more wise. You don't get into delusions, into tricks. I don't know how many times, sometimes when you do a magic trick, one of the monks here, when he was, no, he's not here now, he's still a monk over in England, and whenever he used to do magic tricks, you know, it was wonderful to see him do a magic trick, because how on earth couldn't see that? And it's always the magician, is there, you know, just like getting a piece of paper and then they suddenly disappear, they're gone. And of course, you know, because it's just diverting your attention to where you're supposed to be looking, and he was very good at that. He did that mostly to entertain kids when he was young, a young man. And anyway, that it's just distorting one's perception so you can't see where you're supposed to be looking. You're looking for somewhere else. And that's the old trick. That's one of the reasons why, you know, that friend I was mentioning already, Bernard Carr, and, you know, he was one of the group I was in, you know, messing around together as young students. And the fellow who was the head ghost hunter was Dr. Tony Cornell. And Tony Cornell, you know, he said whenever he went to investigate a haunting, he said the most amazing and trustworthy and revealing piece of scientific equipment he took with him was a professional musician. A professional magician. And he said, a professional magician knew all the tricks how to distort and deceive people. And he wanted to find out whether this was a real haunting or whether it was just a setup. And he found out that the best person to be with was a professional magician who knew all the tricks. I remember him telling me that sometimes you get a coin like that, and this professional magician get a piece of rice and put it right through the coin and come out the other side, a solid coin. How the heck did you do that? It's impossible. And then, the magician shows you how it's done. And most time, you think afterwards, oh, crikey, how did I miss that? There's an obvious trick. But it's the most obvious tricks are the ones which are most deceptive, because one is not looking for them. So that's one of the reasons why avijja, the delusive part of the way that our perceptions and will and conceptions all work, is a much, much, much better translation than ignorance. Because if you want to use ignorance, then just go to university. Just go look at the books and work out what it all means. Does that actually get you enlightened? Sometimes when you read the books, you become an expert. You can go to universities and teach other people what jhana is. You haven't got a clue what it is yourself. And it distorts reality. And I did that, remember, because I was a theoretical physicist at Cambridge. You got some weird stuff over there. And it would even like fool someone like Albert Einstein, who when quantum physics started, he said, it can't be right, it's wrong. And even Albert Einstein was wrong there. He just couldn't see it. His mind was just so limited. He had wisdom, he had knowledge, but he didn't have the wisdom. And that was Albert Einstein. I don't know if you heard the story about Albert Einstein when he first went to the United States. And you know, people knew about him, he was a famous, well-known, but they hadn't seen him before. And those were the years when they didn't have internets and TVs and Facebooks. They just knew that he was a famous professor, you know, from Europe. I think from Austria or wherever. But anyway, when he landed and in a boat, didn't have aircraft, and they managed to arrange a professional chauffeur. And the job of the chauffeur was to take him from university to university, make sure he was taken to the place where he could spend the night. And the same chauffeur throughout the whole trip on the East Coast of the United States, on the Ivy League universities, because they all wanted to have him talk and listen to him. And so the same chauffeur all the time on this couple of weeks tour of the great universities of the Eastern States of United States of America. And after a while, the chauffeur, after about 5 or 6 days of this, said to Albert Einstein, you know, I've been in the back where you've been lecturing. It's the same lecture all the time. And I think I know it by heart now, that I could give it. Like many of you have listened to my talks again and again and again. You've heard all the old jokes many, many times. I'm sure that you could say those jokes. And that's what he said to Professor Einstein. Professor Einstein said, oh yeah, that's interesting. Let's do an experiment. So before they arrived at the next university, they swap places. Albert Einstein went in the front of the car and wore the cap, and the chauffeur was in the back with the pipe, looking sort of Albert Einstein-y, whatever that looks like. And of course, when they got to the next university, you know, the dignitaries received the car and they opened the car, and they're back, oh, Professor Einstein, it's a great honor for you to come to our university. We're all so excited you're going to give a talk to us tonight. And the chauffeur, you know, said, oh, yes, yes, very good. And Professor Einstein at the front was enjoying the scam to see if he could get away with it. And then they took the chauffeur, you know, to the faculty room and had a nice lunch or dinner, whatever it was. Albert Einstein had to go and eat with the porters or whatever. And when they came time for the talk, the chauffeur went up to the lectern and, you know, just off the cuff, he said such a beautiful lecture on special relativity or whatever it was. And everybody afterwards, they stood up and they gave him a standing ovation. It was perfect. Because, you know, he learns it. He's got a good memory. But of course, there's always someone in the audience who likes to ask questions. And it was one of his professors. And he said, Professor Einstein, he addressed the chauffeur, and he said, that was very interesting what you said. But what about, you know, whispers, blah, blah, blah. And a really deep question on special relativity or whatever. And a chauffeur looked at this professor who was trying to catch him out. And the chauffeur said, "Professor," pretending to be Albert Einstein, "Professor, you know, that is such a simple question on special relativity. It's so basic. Even my chauffeur in the back could answer that one." And the chauffeur did. I'm sure you could do the same. So tomorrow morning's lecture will be given by Nicholas and myself. It takes me back and forth. Anyway, don't know where that came from. Anyway, meditation can uncover hidden anger, ill will, and fears. That is an interesting suggestion. That is understanding, having the view, the delusion, that anger, ill will, and fears are things which exist. If they don't manifest, you know, in your behavior, you think they're hiding down there somewhere, and they're just always existing, and sometimes they manifest because they appear above the surface. But the way that Buddhism works, it's just anger is the result of causes and conditions. And those causes and conditions are always changing. It's like what we say is a process. And it's a process. They're not there all the time. Just like I mentioned, the stream of consciousness simile of the Buddha, standing on the bridge, the water is never the same. You know, you might think that there's like a bubble there, but the bubble just comes up in this moment, then disappears again. The bubble isn't always in there, but you can't see it. So this is process, cause and effect all the time. So anger isn't permanent. It's not always there. Stupidity isn't always there. It's these tendencies are. And if the wrong thing happens or the causes are there, then the anger comes up. If the right conditions are there, things like anger never come up. You're free of those things. Anger is just a desperate last attempt to have some control. Because it's somebody's fault. Your fault. Your fault. Your fault. Somebody's fault. You get angry. When you realize it's no one's fault. This is life. Welcome to life. How many perfect people are there in this world? None. There's no even people here. It's just little processes going, and sometimes, boom, it makes a bit of a noise. Sometimes it does stupid things. Welcome to life. So don't try and cure all of your attachments. That is not the way of Buddhism, to kill them or get rid of them all. The way of Buddhism is to... This moment is the most important moment in the whole world, not right now. The thing right in front of you, you're dealing with, that's the most important. In other words, that's really all there really is. And your job is just caring for things. Not curing them. Caring. And you find that angry eating monsters disappear. Very simple, but very incredibly profound. And this is actually just why the whole idea that anger, ill will, and fears are sometimes hidden. Not hidden there. The tendency, the opportunities for those things to manifest. When they don't manifest, they don't exist somewhere. The mind relaxes and tension. Oh, when seen properly, it's like something blocking us is unplugged. The mind relaxes and tension and debris are released. Sometimes it can be easy to outflow into sensory desire in celebration instead of going inward. You know, a lot of time you see it in a different way. Just how this mind is. All these experiences, phenomena which you experience, they're not always there. When the anger is not there, it's not waiting, it's gone. Then it comes up again. Why? delusion, expectations, thinking you're in control. I have to say this, Simon, if I don't get enough questions answered, I'll do them tomorrow morning. But this particular simile is one which I worked out years ago. Actually, I don't know when, because it was 1991, I think. Yeah, 91, of the driverless bus simile. And it's a beautiful simile. It's imagine a driverless bus. This was 91. I mentioned the year because it was before things like Google even existed. And the idea of a driverless bus is the old simile of your life being a bus journey. And you're sitting in the bus and you look through the window and you get some wonderful experiences in your life. All the wonderful happy times you've had. You know, mostly in China Grove, but other places as well. And you know what happens when you have these wonderful experiences in life? You know, you want it to last as long as possible. So you ask the bus driver to please slow down, even park. I want to enjoy these experiences. And what does the bus driver usually do? He doesn't follow instructions. No, he just puts the feet down hard on the accelerator. Whoosh! And the beautiful experiences of your life don't last as long as they should do. And then when you're having terrible experiences in your life, a lot of pain and frustration and difficulties, and oh, sometimes life can be so hard. And so what do you want to do? You want to get out of there as soon as you can. What really happens? The bus driver stops and barks. He said, what are you doing that for? You've got a stupid bus driver. So then you have to go and say, well, I'm going to teach this bus driver how to drive a bus properly. So many people come to retreats like this or other places to try and make sure you have more happiness and less suffering. In order to try and find a way of teaching that bus driver, look, when it is painful, difficult, find a way of getting out of there as soon as you can. And when it's beautiful, stop, for goodness sake. What's harder, you know, enduring or stopping? Stop. Let's enjoy the happy times of our life. But the bus driver is just so difficult to teach. And you realize the only way you can teach the bus driver, you've got to find the bus driver first. Where on earth is the bus driver sitting? Inside of you. Where? That's a job of meditation. You find the bus driver's seat. It takes a lot of meditation to go deep inside who's actually making the decisions, or what's making the decisions inside of you. Why do you choose to do what you do? And why do you sometimes do, honestly, stupid decisions? You know it's wrong, it's going to hurt, but you still do it anyway. Why on earth does stupid bus driver create trouble for you? And then, eventually find the bus driver's seat. The thing which chooses, which drives your life. So you think, I can teach this bus driver now. But then you get one of the biggest insights, and it's shocking. It's not what you expected at all. You find your bus driver's seat is empty. There's no one there. That's pretty shocking. Your bus is out of control. You heard that somewhere before? Why? There's nothing there, said Ajahn Chah. Bus driver's seat is empty. So what do you do? You go back to your seat, you shut up and stop complaining. There's no one to complain to. In other words, you give up desire and ill will. You are now contented and easily satisfied. There's no one driving your bus. Yay! So if you don't like what I say here, you really think the jokes are too bad. So it's not my fault. I'm not driving this bus. You can blame Ajahn Chah. You can blame my father, because my father told terrible jokes. He was the one who came home one day, he really scared me. He said one of his friends had an accident at work. And they took him to hospital, and they had to amputate his leg. Terrible thing, you lose your leg. But then he said, when they, after the operation, they found out it does actually happen. They cut off the wrong leg.
Oh no.
It does happen. And so they had to take him back inside and cut the other leg off because it was unviable. And when he recovered enough, he got a lawyer and he sued them. He lost his case. He didn't have a leg to stand on. Oh, don't blame me. That's what my father told me. But that's really amazing that when you understand that, ooh, a driverless bus. So much freedom there. When you don't try and control the bus, it usually goes much more peacefully through your life. Next, Jirajan. How to tolerate a partner who cannot even do one thing correctly? Whatever my partner did, I have to go over and redo it. You are so fortunate. I won't say which partner it is, because how to tolerate a partner. But anyhow, okay, I'll say what it says. How can I tolerate a husband who can't even do one thing correctly? Whatever he did, I have to go over and redo it. You know one of the things your husband did? He remarried you. So whatever he did, he married you, you need to go over and redo it. Okay, don't blame me. I often punch my line manager in my mind. Oh, in your mind. When I had a tough day at work. Now I realize that this might be an ill will, but the punch marks make me feel better. What should I do? So is this the same person here with your husband? It looks the same. So what... It makes you feel okay, but the line manager keeps on making mistakes and does tough things afterwards. So it's not really a solution. It makes you feel better temporarily. But then, when I had a tough day at work, isn't there other ways to deal with a tough day at work? You know, one of the best ways of dealing with a tough day at work is actually find time to go to the restroom or a meditation room or to take time away. And when you take time out, you sit there and just relax your mind. Do some meditation for 10 minutes. Just 10 minutes. 15 minutes if you want in the restroom. And when your manager tells you that, oh my goodness, that, you know, why do you spend so much time in the restroom? You tell them you're constipated. And it's true, you're constipated inside your mind. You're sick with ill will. So that's much better. And when you really relax, I mean really relax, you don't feel angry anymore. All right, just the punch manager, or the line manager is also stressed out, you're stressed out. And so just, and taking time out, when you really relax, you find you get all this energy and innovation and other ways of doing things. And so you become much more productive when you take some time out. When you get tired. Ajahns, please explain what is meant by fetters. Is it the same as kilesas? Apologies if this was explained earlier and I missed it with metta. Yeah, well, the 10 fetters. The first 3 fetters is the main one, is the idea of a self, a me, a mine. I am this, or this is mine, or this is myself. Concerning especially the components of existence. That is the big first fetter. Thinking there's something permanent, which is always going to be there, which is you. And people find all sorts of ways to try and construct a sense of self. Even when you get in deep meditation, that is one of the real reasons why you get afraid. When you get into deep meditation. Because it's like, you know, you, as you know it, is disappearing. You know that sometimes I used to have in the horror shows when I was young, because it was a Christian country in the UK, they said the scariest thing was if a monster came into your life. And the monster said, I've come here to take over your soul. And they said, what would you do, Ajahn Brahm, if some monster, some devil came? I've come here to take over your soul. And I would say, you're welcome, there's nothing there. Would you be afraid of losing something which doesn't exist? Of course not. So that's one of the wonderful things to know, when it's just this process. And the self-view is a big one. Once that disappears, you're basically a stream winner. You're destined to become enlightened. You've seen there's nothing in there. There's safety now. And then afterwards you start letting go of what's the next couple of things. Is like doubt and the belief that just through rites and rituals that you can become enlightened. And people actually still think that if you do some chanting, then you become enlightened. Haven't you listened to our chanting? Can you get enlightened with that? It can help, but just by itself it's not enough. And once those three fetters are abandoned, then you can say you're a stream winner. And what does it mean that, you know, that there's no self in there, and when everything fades away, everything fades away? What it really means, you have this Agni-Vajra-Gotra Sutta. It's one of the favorite suttas in there, which is so clear. And it was that this wanderer would say, well, you know, once an arahat dies, what happens? Where do they go? Can they go to some little retirement home only reserved for arahats? No one else allowed in. Where all the arahats can live happily ever after. The ultimate retirement home in the sky. People always like that, you know, that idea of Prince Charming and Cinderella. Is it Cinderella or Sleeping Beauty or something? I don't know. But anyway, they ride off into the distance, happy ever after. How many people get happy ever after once they get married? If they said that Prince Charming rode off into Jhana Grove and lived happily ever after, that's getting much closer. But even that, if they say that Prince Charming disappeared and was happy ever after, that's getting closer. But anyway, Agni-Vajra-Gotra, the Buddha said, look at this, a fire. And the Buddha said like a grass fire, wood fire, but now I'd like to use the idea of a candle. If you see a candle flame, what is the flame? What is it? What's its nature? What's its essence? What's it exists? It's just a combination. One accurate way of looking at it, according to the Buddha, is a combination of the heat, the wax in the candle, and the wick. Those three things come together and you see a flame. And if the wick is all burnt through, it's exhausted, no more wick left, what happens to the flame? It goes out. If the wick is exhausted, the wax is all used up, then what happens? Flame goes out. Where does it go? It doesn't go anywhere, it's just gone. What happens if the wind blows the heat away? Then the flame goes out. See, because all that flame is a combination of those three things. When those three things come together, you get flame. When those three things, one of those three things stops, the flame. You know the word they use for that in Pali? It nibbanas. Nibbutau. Nibbuto tang padding yatayang padipo. They use that in the Ratana Sutta. It goes out, just like the flame goes out when the oil lamp is all just used up. And they use that word. And that word, I say Nibbana, Nibbuto. Nibbuto is a past participle, Nibbana is a noun, that's all it is. That's the only difference, it means the same thing. They say that even every kid in India would know that word. And they wouldn't need to be a professor of philosophy or a monk or a nun to know the meaning of that word. Even kids would know that word. Just Nibbana means the flame's gone out. It doesn't go anywhere. But everyone wants to have... It's actually called bhava-dhanha, the craving to be, to exist in any sort of way. And it's one of the most difficult fetters to overcome. But then after that it's overcome, the other ones just go automatically. The greed or wanting and ill will, those are the second two fetters. And the last fetters are rupa-raga, arupa-raga. You know what those mean? Those are the attachment desire for the jhana realms and the immaterial realms. So I mentioned there is still an attachment, but it's the only, it stops you being attached to the jhanas and the things beyond those jhanas. All that does, it just stops you being fully enlightened. You're only just right next door to enlightenment. You're a non-returner. It's not a bad deal. I think many of you, even ask the monks and the nuns, many of the monks and nuns will be happy with that. So it's not a big deal. But those are the next two fetters, and the fetters after that is mana, udicca, and abhijja. Mana is just the thought I am. Just we got so used to using that language that it still remains for a while, but it can't last. That's why the simile was used by Kemaka. He said, it's just like you washed your robe. It still smells. Now in the suttas, believe it or not, in that time, they would wash it with cow dung. Really weird. But then I said, if I made that simile, then people would just be wondering, what do they wash the things with cow shit for? But that was just to be the way in those days. But anyway, if you say you can't relate to that, that's why the similes, it's okay to change those similes as long as you're not changing the meaning of it, but enhancing the meaning of it, making it clearer. So I said, just why not say that when you wash your clothes, after you wash your clothes, you put them on the line, you can still smell the smell of the washing powder. You still smell that, but after a while, how long does the smell of the washing powder last? As long as you air it, it doesn't last that long, and the smell goes away, it fades away. So that's like the I am thought. After a while, it just fades away. The last vestige. So those are the fetters. Same as kilesas. Kilesas are greed, hatred, and delusion. Apologies. What are apologies? Unnecessary. I don't know why people say that. Somebody bumps you in the street. You're walking down the street and somebody bumps into you because they're not being mindful. And you're the one who says sorry. So you shouldn't say sorry, you didn't do anything wrong. So you're the one who says sorry, you know, you were watching your iPad or iPhone. But why is it we always say sorry? And you're lying, you're breaking your precepts, you weren't sorry. It's just our culture. Anyway, during the autopsy of an equal-aged person, you were taken. What did you mean by that? Why was it different to the others? I could relate to it. It made sense, because when you see an autopsy, sometimes it's too clean. It's almost like you can relate to it as being a human being, but it's not a human being who's alive. There's something different in it. But when you see it, someone who's like you in some sort of way, that relation, I felt, you know, that could have been me in there. And I really did, because it looked a little bit like me, the same age, the same. And that ability to make an association, this is not just being a scientist and looking through the window of a door into somebody else's house, you're actually in that house. So I couldn't actually just call compartmentalize and thereby to resist the conclusions that I was seeing a human being who was so similar to me. He was lying dead there. I was standing watching. That was the only thing that it affected me. That's why sometimes that people can, they can even listen to all these things. Oh yeah, that makes sense. When that starts to happen to you, you know, even meditation and jhanas and stuff, you're actually experiencing it. That's so much different than hearing about it from a monk like me. Can you please ask people not to put hot mugs on the bamboo floor? Please do not put hot mugs on the bamboo floor. Did I do that? No, I didn't do that. You try your very best. But if you did it wrong, what punishment can we give to you? Because if you don't have a punishment for it, then people will keep doing it. So what to do? What to do is, if you break that rule from now on, you put a hot mug on a bamboo floor. You have to hug the teddy bear for the next meditation session. Learn some kindness, compassion. So the bamboo floor looks pretty good. Maybe. But anyway, try not to put it on. Actually, we've got bamboo in the huts as well, haven't we? Yeah. But it's the nature of things. They decay and get dirty. I should say this when the cleaners are here. But it's the nature of things. I believe Chaganusati and Silanusati are about reflecting the past good deeds to increase one's positive merit account. More than that. Is this part of Vipassana teachings or is it explained in any sutta? It's explained in the suttas. I'd like to understand the process, please, with much metta. You can try it from the suttas, but isn't it better to actually to try it yourself? What good things have you done today? All right, here we go. One of those great experiences. Suttas are great to check you on the right track, but some of the experiences you have are just, woof. You see these robes over here, that in Thailand, in the forest tradition, we'd have to make our robes ourselves. And it was the custom in Ajahn Chah's monastery in those early days that we'd have to, when you ordain as a monk, as a bhikkhu, you'd have to make your three robes yourself from white cloth. So you get the white cloth out and you'd, you know, cut it, then you have to sew it and get the right way of sewing it. We did have a sewing machine, just the treadle one, but you know, you had to. I remember sometimes seeing one of these monks, he was sewing his robe, and I went past the place where they could sew, and he was banging the sewing machine against the wall. You stupid machine, you stupid machine. I mean, you understand what I mean? People sometimes doing that with your laptop or something, you stupid laptop, you crashed again, stupid laptop. You know, one thing I know from technology is that sewing machines don't have a consciousness. They don't deliberately have it in for you. And why do people get angry like that? They don't really understand. It's just the sewing machine. It's you were just too rushed and you made a mistake. But anyway, we had to make our own ropes. And that was just sewing them. And after sewing them, you had to wash them to get any grease out. Just use with, you know, ordinary soap powder, like you. But you don't have any washing machines. It's just in a bucket and dry them. And then you have to make the dye. And that was the hard part because the dye was made out of the jackfruit tree. So the jackfruit tree, whenever any jackfruit tree fell over or a branch came off in the storm, the villagers would always take it to the monastery. And we'd get a machete, and a proper machete, and just hammer it, or not hammer it, just get the chips off the wood. So you had to first of all learn how to sharpen that machete, and if you didn't know how to do that, you'd take hours. And when you had a very sharp machete, of course, I was a theoretical physicist, I was not sort of a woodworker. You can imagine how many cuts you got on your hand after a few minutes, but you soon learned. It's a wonderful way of learning. But anyway, and once you got all those chips of the jackfruit tree wood, then you get a big pot, a big basin, and then once you had a big basin, just like the the bowl for the donga, which is still hiding behind a teddy bear, but much bigger. Just get some water and put some ashes underneath because you didn't want that to go rusty, and get wood from the forest to light it, to make a fire. And then the water you had to get from the well, because we didn't have any running water. It was all just with a bucket and a piece of bamboo. And you soon learn how to hook it and bring it up. And of course, when you first did that, you lost many, many buckets. And whoever lost the bucket had to go down the well with a piece of rope and get the bucket up again. Unfortunately, sometimes there were snakes down that well. So you had to be very careful to make sure you don't sort of get bitten. And once you've got enough buckets of water, then you boil up the water, put the chips in there and boil it and boil it and boil it until the dye comes out. And then you strain it into another receptacle, and you make some more and some more and some more. And then you dye the wood. So you have to make it sure it's very hot, and you put the wood in its wooden basis, and you pour the brown dye made out of jackfruit drupe, and you hit it and 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 hit it. And sometimes it does help if you are angry at somebody. You hit and hit and hit it. It makes life a bit faster. And then you have to dry it. And because it's a natural dye, you have to be around it all the time. You put it on the line and you keep have to change it. Change it this way, change it that way, because if you don't change it, it'll all streak. And then once it's dried once, then you have to do it all over again because there's not enough colour in it yet. So that, I think I've made the point that it's really a long, hard work. And it usually takes a couple of days. No sleep. If you just do one. On this occasion, there were 3 monks ordaining. And they'd already been up for about 2 nights without any sleep at all. Because the rule was you had to do it yourself. It's just, you know, showing that you really wanted to become a monk. And so 2 monks had, you know, been up for two nights all by themselves. So 3 monks been up 2 nights. And after the evening meeting, I'm a softie, you know, I think you probably know that, that I just sneaked into the dyeing shed. And I said, look guys, you know, you must be so tired. So I'll take over tonight, just don't tell anybody. I'm breaking the local monastic rule. You know, they never argued, they ran. Before I changed my mind. You know what it's like, you haven't slept for 2 nights. You know, you feel just really, almost like you feel like drunk. Your mindfulness is not clear, it's dangerous. So anyway, they went off, and I did the dying by myself just until the 3 o'clock bell. And then they came back. And I said, oh, thank you so much. I only had about 3 hours or 4 hours sleep, but that made all the difference, have a break. And then I went back into the 3 o'clock, straight back into the hall. I never went back to my room, never had any sleep that night. And I just did the chanting and meditate. But you know, that morning, I had really good meditation. My mind was really peaceful. And I wasn't sleepy at all, even though I hadn't had any sleep. And then afterwards, went on the arms round afterwards, and I had, oh no, the chanting as well. When you have lots of energy, I can't resist it. Yo, so! Quieting down. And walking on arms round afterwards, I had so much energy, and I was so happy. And I couldn't help but ask the senior monk afterwards, I said, look, I apologize. I broke the local agreement rule that monks are supposed to do this thing by themselves. But I was so sorry for those 3 monks, they were so tired. And, you know, but the weird thing was, I haven't slept all night. I've been working hard, and I've got all this incredible energy. Why? And the senior monks quickly said, it was obvious, I don't know why I didn't see it myself. It's because you've been letting go and helping others. Oh yeah, I was kind. And amazing the amount of energy which you can get when you are just, it's not your job, you know, you don't need to do it, but you see someone who's missed their lunch or something and you're going to take them something. Or that somebody is sick and they're in the room there and they're supposed to be washing up and they can't do it. You do it for them. You get so much happiness out of that. And physical energy as well. That's the thing which I was really shocked with, the physical energy. You know, I hadn't slept all night, I was full of energy. Simply because I've helped somebody who really needed it. So that's a chaganusati and a silanusati. What you've given to others, if you've really given it with a pure heart, oof, you get huge energy. And if you're keeping precepts and being really kind and being good, trustworthy, oh wow, it feels gorgeous inside. It's one of the reasons it's the source of inner happiness. You got those five precepts, and after a while you realize just how amazing they are. And you become a person people trust. You won't take any money from anybody, steal any money, and you just you won't sort of lie to anybody. And that gives you so much energy, so much happiness and joy. Anyway, dear Ajahn, why can't monks and nuns declare their enlightenment to lay people? That why they can't is because if they do, great deal of trouble comes. For example, that or was I again? If I declare to everybody that I can read minds. Now this is only a metaphor, okay? Don't take this seriously. If I told you that I can read minds, what would happen next? The CIA, or MI5, or ACO over here, they say, great, can you come to the airport? Because sometimes we arrest possible terrorists. We don't know whether they really are terrorists or not. You can come in there, read their minds, and tell us all about it. It will save us so much time. Or maybe the Liberal Party are in power right now. Can you please just go and read the leader of the opposition's mind and find out what he's really up to? Or you may say, can you really read my wife's mind? Because I've got some really serious concerns about her. You'd be in really big trouble, wouldn't you? If you really think about it, it'd be okay for you. Oh yeah, that's really interesting. Suppose you could read the future. Ajahn Brahm, I'm really struggling to survive in this economic climate. I promise I'll give you 10% to your monastery or whatever you're doing. What are the lottery numbers? The last time I told this story was recently. I was doing a retreat for the Thai people, and it happened to be Melbourne Cup Day. And a few of them said, Ajahn Brahm, can you help, please? So I told them a story. This was the story of the five angels. There was a gentleman here in Perth. Before he woke up, he had these very prophetic dreams. You know, dreams very clear. But weird. In his dream, he dreamt of these five angels. And they were lining up and they were wanting to give him something. The first angel gave him five pots full of gold coins. And the second angel did the same. Another five containers of gold coins. And the third did the same, fourth and fifth the same too. Had 25 big containers, all full of gold coins. It was worth a fortune. And of course, that's when he woke up, when he got the last container of gold coins. And then he looked in his room. There were no angels there. He didn't mind that, but there's no gold coins. That was disappointing. But nevertheless, it was a great dream. So he went down for breakfast. And when he went down for breakfast, he found that his wife that morning, she'd already gone off to work, had made him five boiled eggs and five pieces of toast for breakfast. And he thought, "What? This is weird. Why five?" And he looked at the newspaper, morning newspaper. It was the 5th of May, the fifth day of the fifth month. So he's not usually a gambler, but he looked at the horse racing in the back and he saw that in race number 5, his eyes almost popped out. race number five, horse number five, was called Five Angels. Oh, this was just an omen. And he realized, he was smart enough to know you only get these lucky chances maybe once in your life, but no, not even that sometimes. So he decided that it can't be wrong. So he went to the racetrack. But oh, I didn't mention the racetrack where the race was on, this is in Perth, was a racetrack called Ascot. A-S-C-O-T. Five letters. It was all coming together. So to keep the lucky number five, he went to his bank and he took out $5,000. And if you're going to do this, you might as well just, you only have it chance once, so do it properly. So he went into the racetrack and the window, the fifth window in line for the bookkeepers, or you know, the people who actually take your bets, and he put $5,000 to win on race number five, horse number five, Five Angels. He knew the lucky number five could not be wrong. The lucky number five wasn't wrong. His horse came in fifth. So you don't have to do the future. So it's much better to not declare your enlightenment to anybody. And there's this one, which is, yeah, this one, she's a Korean, South Korean nun, and she said, if you do happen to get enlightened, don't tell anyone. Otherwise, you'll have to spend the rest of your life proving it. I thought it was very wise. There's such things as jealousy for unenlightened people. So prove it. Yeah, you're not really enlightened, are you? So you have to prove it. Anyway, is there an age limit for lay people to become monks and nuns? Yeah, there is a lay, as long as you're still breathing. In some monasteries we do have age limits, so, and the main reason for that is sometimes that when you get old, you know that sometimes you're very hard to look after. And some of the monks or the nuns have to spend so much time looking after you. And you do that out of kindness, you always will do that out of kindness. But then you don't have that much time to meditate or do any other duties as well. You won't be able to come and give talks or go to Nalamara to give any talks because you're always looking after the oldies. It's a shame, but I don't know other ways of getting around this. That's one of the reasons why I know that Dhammasara have the rule, the 50, the oldest. But in the Ayana monastery, we haven't got a rule about that. But if we did have a rule, it's not a Vinaya rule. It's just, you know, for practicalities. And usually, I don't know why I say these things, because if you really, 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 really have done a lot of good for the monastery or for the BSWA, yeah, we'll find a way to get you in. How old is Aya Gotami? How many years have you been there? So you were ordained after you were 50. You got in somehow.
Yes.
Yeah, she can get in. So it really depends, it's much harder. Anyway, how did Ananda know the four paths of arahatship before he himself was, before the Buddha's council? Because he was told by the Buddha. So he was the go-to person. What did the Buddha say? Okay, if Bhikkhu is a male monk and Bhikkhuni is a female nun, if someone was non-binary and wanted to join, would Buddhism then be challenged with modern times and maybe equality a label for just monks for all in the future? Is non-binary is a difficult one we haven't faced yet, but when we have gay monks or lesbian nuns or all the different LGBTQIA+, is basically, where do you think you'd feel comfortable and other people feel comfortable with you? It's just the practicalities of a monastery, nothing about discrimination. And so I remember it was a rule in Thailand that you weren't supposed to ordain gay monks. That was supposed to be. But there was a loophole. And because it's one of the great things about studying Pali and reading the commentaries in Pali and finding out all these loopholes. And it was a bit strange, but it said that there are some people who are only like gay for 2 weeks out of every month. I can't understand that myself. But I'm glad that was in the ancient commentaries, because what that means, you've got the loophole there. See, it says it in there. And so, the loophole was extended that when the first man I sort of ordained who was openly gay, a really good monk, and I was really happy that I gave him ordination, because, you know, he's now a great sort of monk, enormous. I won't say who he is. But when I did give him the ordination, I asked him, I said, well, can you handle it in a community of men? What would happen if you see a really hot guy come into this monastery? How would you behave? And he said, look, you know, I can restrain my sexuality just like Ajahn Brahm, you have to, if you see a beautiful girl come into the monastery, like all the other monks have to. And I just go back to my heart and just lay down for a while until I can cool off. And I said, well, look, give it a try, see how it goes. Because, you know, the sensuality there was, you know, because he had good meditation, it was being reduced. And he lasted so well. And you know, now he's a senior monk. I won't say who he is. And I'm so happy I did that. Because, you know, why not give people a chance, give people the opportunities if they want to? I've got no right to hinder people. And as long as they can do it, and they fit in and they do a good job, and he does a wonderful job. Really great that I just decided to do that and give it a try. And it worked so well. So it really doesn't matter that much. Can you live the monastic life? I can have difficulty. If you're not, fine. And also the nice thing about Buddhist monastic life in this tradition, that you can give it a try. If it doesn't work, you disrobe. And Benicio gave it a try, and it was a wonderful. And okay, just the last story. Here's the last little story here. That as many, I don't think I told it, I told it up in the upstairs in the dining hall when people visited. I said that sometimes that if it doesn't work out for a monk or for a nun, they disrobe. But especially for monks, because I know this, because the monastery's been there for much longer, and quite a few people have disrobed. But when the monk disrobes, especially if they're a young monk who disrobes, oh, they're very popular with the Buddhist young women who are not married yet. Because it's happened so many times that once they get married, the new wife comes out to me and says, thank you so much, Ajahn Brahm, for training my husband. How many husbands can you get know how to wash up and to cook and to fix things, and they're so obedient and kind and wise, and they never get angry because they've been trained by Ajahn Brahm? I said, oh, thank you, Ajahn Brahm, for training him before he disrobed and I caught him in time. Actually, no, I won't embarrass anybody. They usually make really good husbands. So that's why, and anybody sees Winnie the Monk's, you know, just getting a bit sort of restless and wants to disrobe, I said, Ajahn Brahm, can you tell me? And I see him over there. Is he? They're really good catches. Imagine. Just all the training they do over there. But anyway, so there's none available right now, so sorry. So, 1, 2, 3, because it's 20 past, and sorry for going on a bit long, but I hope you enjoyed it. There's some questions left, but that could be for tomorrow. Oh, yeah, so tomorrow, who's answering the questions? The bhikkhunis, so be kind to them. Sadhu, sadhu, Sadhu. Let's see a different intonation. Okay, so when it comes to tomorrow, not just one nun, it should be shared between all four. Hopefully that is she getting better now? Venerable?
She's resting.
Oh, resting, okay. Preparing herself tomorrow. So be kind, it's just, and you can ask, this is a question, you know, for Venerable Gotami, this is a question for somebody else. So that way, and you're quite okay if you think it's too deep a question or embarrassing a question, can you please just leave it for me the next night, on Saturday night? Because tomorrow is Friday. So if you have a question here you think you want to defer to me, then keep it in the box here and I can answer it the next day. Okay? Very good. Okay, so good night everybody. Have a wonderful evening if you wish.